last day of oral argument this week. Judge Martin and I are delighted to welcome to sit with us for the second time this week, Judge John Rogers of the Sixth Circuit. He comes from the town of Lexington, Kentucky, and we're delighted to have him. He's sat with us before, and he is what I affectionately referred to as, when I'm on a panel, as a full load-bearing judge. He does his part of the work, and we deeply appreciate it. And as long as he's sitting with this court, he has every bit as much authority and responsibility and duty as Judge Martin and I do. So, welcome again.
Very kind, thank you.
All right, first case up, U.S. versus Chambliss, Mr. Maddox.
Good morning, Your Honors. I apologize for the clerk for not being here at the time she asked. I was in miscommunication, but I'm glad I'm here before Your Honors. I'd like to focus your attention this morning on what I believe is the most important of the four arguments that Mr. Chambliss made, which is argument two, the entrapment issue. As this court well knows, entrapment and the failure to give an instruction, 13.1 under this court's standardized jury instructions, can result in the need for a reversal and a new trial, and that's exactly what happened here. I'd like to discuss the fact that the government cited in a letter that U.S. v. Dixon seems to have decided that the standard is de novo. We, of course, agree with that, and come before Your Honors noting there's two types of entrapment. One is the estoppel entrapment. That's not what we're here about. We're here about the garden variety entrapment, and that a person who's not predisposed to commit a crime is someone who should not be found guilty if the government induced the conduct. And here, the inducement is one issue, and we know that Mr. Hammond, the confidential informant, was in fact working for the government, so that's not a question. The second issue is the key issue for this court, a lack of predisposition on the part of the defendant. Now, frankly, judges, it's a tough issue because I think you're probably looking at the record saying, well, where is the defense evidence? Mr. Chambliss did not testify. He used his Fifth Amendment right to not do so. However, we just have to show evidence on the issue of persuasion or mild coercion, and it has to be viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Chambliss. And when you look at this record, while we bear that burden, it is shifted because of the totality of the evidence that came out upon the presentation of the government's case and upon cross-examination. And let me tell you what I'm talking about. When the inducement requires a showing of persuasion or mild coercion, we know that. Why did that happen here? And what can serve as that evidence? Number one, evidence that the defendant did not favorably receive the government's plan. That evidence is the hallmark of something that I'd like to point out that wasn't pointed out in our briefs, but record evidence. And what I'd like to bring the court's attention to is if you look at Doc 166 on page 51, the United States has made a large deal out of the fact that there's case law. I believe Judge Carnes, you authored the case law talking about guns and drugs go together like peas and carrots. And for purposes of my argument, I'd like you to consider the analogy in this case that the carrots are the drugs and the peas are the guns, because in fact, they do have a transcript where my client referred to bring the pea shooter. And so peas are going to be the gun and carrots are going to be the drugs. This entire case, and we argued that part of the grounds for a new trial should be that the drug evidence wasn't intrinsically linked, but Judge Kovacevic decided that it was, let it in, and so now the government has to deal with the fact that the record shows only that Mr. Chambliss was involved in drugs. And why is that significant? Because Mr. Hammond, the CI, testified that he knew my client for years and met with him on a daily basis to buy Doritos or Dilaudids. Okay, all that's about drugs for years. That's the evidence. Go to the second, cooperating witness trying to get a better deal. That's Mr. Rucker. Mr. Rucker came here from the Pittsburgh area, eventually ended in Inglewood, met my client. They were best friends, according to his testimony at one point. And in that best friendship, all they did was drugs together. So we have a big bowl of carrots with no peas in it. There's no peas in the carrots in this case until Mr. Hammond. And when Mr. Hammond, the confidential informant, shows up, he induces Mr. Chambliss.
Your evidence of inducement.
Yes, Judge.
What exactly did he say that induced your client?
I will tell you, on page 51 of Exhibit 166, the CI, and recall that Agent Balow said they ran out of time on the tape because this took a lot longer than most deals he's done. It was 1 hour and 7 minutes, and they ran out of batteries on the audio. So he's sitting at Chambliss's house. There's people coming in and out. And in the middle of the conversation, before the pea shooter comment, the confidential informant says, "When you get a chance, can I get that bro? I got to haul ass." Chambliss says, "What do you need?" The CI says, "I gave you that 150." And his trial testimony was that he had $150 to buy the gun and $70 for two Dilaudid pills. Chambliss' response, "Huh." Then the CI says, "That was the second pile you picked up. That was 150." Chambliss says, "No, that was for inaudible." So he's contesting what the CI says the transaction's about. Then the CI says, "No," insisting, "I gave you 70, and then I handed you 150. That was the pile right there. That was the 150, bud. I swear on everything that I love." Then we have unintelligible background noise. Then Chambliss responds in what is under the light burden. All we have to show, mild coercion. Clearly, him responding to the CI says, "Take it easy, bro. You got that, bro. You doing what you say you do, bro. Take it easy, man. I ain't tripping. Take it easy, bro. Take it easy. Calm down. Calm down." That's what the tape says. That's the CI coercing and inducing a deal that my client said he wasn't even doing.
Can I ask you about that? Because I'm a little confused about what's being induced. It's all kind of vague. Are you talking about inducing the sale?
Yes, Judge. I'm talking
about... Well, but he's not convicted of selling. He's convicted of possessing.
Right? That's correct.
So if he's... Even if we accept for the moment that there was an inducement of a sale, and I'm not sure I see that. You have much evidence of that, but I can see the argument. But that doesn't get you to getting him to... obtain the gun. The whole idea was that the gun was already obtained, is my understanding. Hammond found out that there was possession of the gun, and in order to prove it, they arranged a sale.
They induced him to disclose something that he possessed.
Yes, and I think that you're going along the lines of the Dixon opinion about...
And I'm not talking about an opinion at all. I'm talking about what it is that you need to show there was evidence of inducement. And you say in your brief, a reasonable jury could have found that Chambliss was induced by Hammond, a government agent, to procure a gun.
Yes.
That's different from to sell a gun, right? You procure it and then you sell it, usually. I mean, I guess you could do it the other way around, but usually you procure a gun and then sell it. I thought the whole assumption here of everybody was that he possessed it, but in order to get evidence of that, you say, induced him to sell it.
Yes, Judge, and perhaps
so
it's...
How is your argument show that he was induced to procure the gun? That's my question.
Yes, Judge. The facts of the case are that the gun was in Mr. Rucker, the cooperating co-defendant's closet, and it is the confidential informant's steps that took the gun out of the friend's closet.
When it was in the closet, according to everybody, though, right?
It was what?
It was his when it was in the closet.
Yes, but according to the
case... That's enough to be convicted, right?
No, Judge. Mere knowledge is not. You have to have dominion and control, and it's the CI's...
But you can't have dominion and control of something that's in somebody else's house?
You have to have steps, and there has to be evidence, and it's the CI's actions that induce the evidence in this case of the dominion and control, because it's a constructive possession case. He was
when you say induce the evidence, that doesn't compute in my mind. What is that?
Well, the reason I'm saying that is because in Dixon, the opinion that set the de novo review, the court said that defendant was prosecuted for possessing the gun and no evidence was adduced at trial suggesting that the government induced the defendant to possess the gun. So the court denied the instruction. I'm saying that the government agent induced the final element of a constructive possession case by getting him to exercise dominion and control over a gun that was sitting in a friend's closet. And so
that was his when it was the whole idea is that it was his when it was sitting in the closet.
It may have been his, but the evidence to prove the elements of constructive possession come from the confidential informant.
So you're saying you can be entrapped into producing evidence of your guilt.
I'm saying that you can be entrapped into producing elements of the crime, yes, because they can't prove.
You would agree that if he constructively possessed it and was simply induced into producing it, there's no viable entrapment defense.
I think that's what Dixon says, yes, Judge.
Okay.
And so in addition to the evidence I've already pointed out, which is clear from the transcript in the CI's own words, that's why my client didn't need to say that he was induced without predisposition. It's here in the record that there's no evidence of him doing anything with a gun until Nate Davis, who never testified, comes and tells Hammond. And then we know Hammond's highly motivated to receive the gun because, in fact, he only ever did drug business with Chambliss. He needed the crime to satiate his drug habit. He testified he needed the money to survive. He was out of work due to a skill saw injury. And so basically, we have a record that has no evidence of any type of firearm possession by my client. And then we have a CI who has a mission because he needs money. He was paid over $10,000 during the course of his relationship.
Rucker testified that Chambliss brought the gun to Rucker's home and asked Rucker to keep it for him.
That's what his testimony is. But in terms of the entrapment, and the full ownership, the gun was sitting in his closet. And at the same time, he also says that he didn't bring it over even though my client supposedly asked for it because he was confused. So I would say that his testimony about that it being in the closet shows that it was delivered and he'd left it. It wasn't with his stash at the house where he sold items, supposedly illegal drugs. And as a result, he didn't have any dominion or control over it sitting in his friend's closet. It wasn't his residence. It was a several-minute drive. So without that, the government has to have the CI's evidence to prove a constructive possession case.
So Rucker entrapped Chambliss when he let Chambliss put the gun there?
That I'm not saying that he was a government actor. I'm saying the government actor is Hammond. I'm saying that evidence.
Yeah, but Rucker testified that Chambliss had brought the gun. You're saying Chambliss brought the gun to Rucker because of Hammond.
No, I think that according to Rucker.
If did Hammond appear in the operative case scene after Chambliss had brought the gun to Rucker's home?
That's according to Rucker's testimony, yes.
Okay, who's not a CI?
Correct.
So for the crime of possession, Chambliss got entrapped after he had brought the gun to Rucker's home.
I see your point that you could argue that there's sort of a split and that they already had enough evidence based on.
It's not just evidence.
Right.
It's the crime.
Yes.
I'm a little bit confused. And then it's not just Rucker's testimony, because the recording device caught Chambliss asking Rucker over the phone, "Hey, remember that little thing about that black thing in your closet? Yeah, the pea shooter. Yeah, the gun, man, the gun. Yes, do it. Bye." I mean, that's Rucker and Chambliss agreeing that Chambliss had brought the gun to Rucker and left it with Rucker. And now he may be induced to get it back, but that's after he's already possessed it, taking it to Rucker, and constructively possessing it by keeping it there with Rucker, his bailee, if you will. Bailee.
I understand your point. However, that's not the case that the government put on, and the jury was induced to find him guilty based on the sale evidence, Hammond's evidence.
Wait. The recording device evidence was put before the jury.
Yes. And I'm saying that that was an unlawful entrapment inducement, that conversation, because my client right before it says, I don't know what you're talking about, and then he has to tell.
Again, you're saying he was induced to produce evidence about what he had done before. Remember, Rucker, when I brought you that gun, and entrapment doesn't extend to produce, you're entrapped to produce evidence of a crime you've already committed. That's not entrapment, as I understand it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honor.
Got your case. Well, we've got 5 minutes.
Yes,
we got your opening case, and now Ms. McNamara.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Linda McNamara for the United States. As the court has been discussing, the evidence showed that Chambliss already possessed the gun before any law enforcement agent got involved. He'd already exercised dominion and control over the gun when he brought it to Rucker's house sometime before April 15th and put it in Rucker's closet. And he possessed it and exercised dominion and control over it on April 15th when he showed it to Rucker and asked him to keep it a little longer for him.
I was a little surprised you didn't make that argument very explicitly in your brief. It just seemed like an easier argument than the one you made.
Your Honor, I agree with you. I think that is the better argument. I fell into the trap of the sale being the possession, which it was. There was possession on that date, but you're right. The possession occurred long before the sale occurred, and that was long before any law enforcement officer had become involved. And that is Dixon, where the court said that the defendant's wished for entrapment defense rests on an undercover detective's attempts to persuade the defendant to sell the gun. But the defendant wasn't prosecuted for selling the gun, he was prosecuted for possessing the gun, and no evidence adduced at trial suggests the government induced the defendant to possess the gun that he later sold, and that's exactly what we have here. His argument about the transcript and what happened on the day of the gun sale doesn't help him anyway. There, when Hammond said, here's your $150, Chambliss didn't say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have anything to sell you. Go away. There was no evidence there that helps show that he was induced to do something that what he was not already inclined to do. He'd already possessed the gun, and he possessed it again that day when he had Rucker bring the gun to him. He hasn't addressed the phone calls, which he'd relied on in his brief, but nothing about those phone calls shows any government inducement. There were 5 calls over the course of 2 days. All of those calls were less than a minute. 2 of them seemed as if they didn't go through. They were only for 0 seconds, the phone records show. And the one call that we do know went through was the 32-second call on the 16th, which we have a record of. And during that call, Hammond says, hey, what's up? And Chambliss says, quit playing with my phone, come to my house. He doesn't say, stop calling me, I don't have anything for you, I don't have anything to sell you. There's just no evidence of inducement here. And for that reason—
I ask you about the probative value of the drug evidence.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't charged with dealing drugs. The evidence was that the drugs were in one place, the gun was in another case. I mean, I just was curious about the decision to introduce that evidence at trial.
All that evidence was relevant and admissible for non-propensity purposes. And let me address each part.
For non-propensity?
The propensity to possess the gun, which is what he was charged with. The evidence that Chambliss was Hammond's drug dealer was admissible to explain the relationship to the two men, to explain why Chambliss would have revealed to Hammond that he possessed a gun and that he had a gun for sale, and why Chambliss would trust Hammond to sell him a gun. That evidence explained also why he was there that day. It was necessary to complete the story of the gun sale. Hammond went there both to buy drugs and to buy guns, and the jury was entitled to know the whole story of what.
Because that's what the CI asked for, right?
That is what the CI asked for, but that was the nature of the relationship between the two people. I mean, it wasn't a relationship based on gun sales, it was a relationship based on drug trafficking, and the jury was entitled to know what the relationship between the two men was. And if he believed that that evidence was unduly prejudicial, the remedy for that would have been a limiting instruction, but he didn't ask for a limiting instruction. So that evidence was admissible to explain the relationship between the two men, what he was doing there that day, and just for the jury to have the whole story of the relationship between the two men. And Judge, of course, if that evidence was not properly admissible, it surely was harmless, given the overwhelming evidence of the gun possession. And I should point out also that the jury was specifically instructed that Chambliss was on trial only for the specific crime charged in the indictment. So there's...
Think about that New Yorker cartoon where the jury's sitting there and their hair's out like that, and the judge says, you will disregard the evidence you just heard.
Well, we assume that the jury follows their instructions, and there's no evidence here that the jury didn't do that. And this isn't the type of evidence that would cause a jury to think because he did this previously, he again did this now. This was evidence that he was engaged in drug trafficking. That's what his relationship was with the informant. And the jury wasn't likely to just infer from that evidence, well, then he likely possessed a gun. It's not the type of propensity evidence that presents that type of danger, especially given the instruction here. If there are no further questions, we'll rest on the brief.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Maddox, 5 minutes if you need it.
Going to the issue of the intrinsically intertwined storytelling, we did file a motion asking, and she's correct, we did not ask for a curative instruction. As I was the individual that tried the case, my position is that you can't unring a bell. And we didn't ask for that. It doesn't mean...
it's more than didn't ask about. The judge said, I'll be glad to give you one, didn't he?
I don't recall that part. She might have. But at that point, the damage was already done. Our position...
You know, that I understand that, and that's valid strategy, and I would never hold some counsel deficient performance for making it, but our cases seem to weigh that pretty heavily.
I'm sorry, our cases?
Our cases seem to weigh the possibility of a curative instruction and being offered one or not rejected when you ask for one fairly heavily in the analysis.
And I understand. I would take it more as our prong three argument that Mr. Chambliss deserves a new trial because the totality of the circumstances between the denied entrapment instruction, the admission of drug evidence, and then the suitability assessment issue, which the government did a good job of pointing out that our brief was probably not as accurate as it should have been about the letters that came in. But the point is, we should have had the entire suitability assessment. This man worked tirelessly as a CI, and we should have been able to sift it pre-trial, not the morning of the second or third day of trial, where we're looking at dozens of pages of records and trying to do a statistical analysis of the influence. And why is that significant? It's significant because it shows a man who is compelled to satisfy his drug habit. When you read the government's brief, he had taken methamphetamine, cocaine, all kinds of substances in his career, and they admit that he probably used before he did the deal. So this is a guy who is going to attempt to get my client to do something he might not otherwise be inclined to do. And going back to the issue, Rucker, curiously, how does it square when the point of Rucker's testimony that I made was, he's a cooperating witness, and he said through all of his time frame of knowing Mr. Chambliss, he never knew him to be associated with guns or the sale of them. That's his testimony. That's why this case smacks of inducement, is because there's just zero evidence that he had any...
I'm sorry, which argument are you making right now?
I'm talking
about... You're talking about the inducement and the entrapment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the entwinement, so I got confused.
Right, I was just saying that we made all three of those arguments, the inextricably intertwined, that it wasn't and shouldn't have been, and the entrapment and the issue of the suitability assessments were all part of our motion for new trial. I'd like to at least talk about my last issue, which I realized that we had cited in our reply brief that Stoeckling is a case that could be informative. The Stoeckling opinion came down, and it definitely focused on force analysis, and I don't know that it really gave a lot to us to argue, but what I'd like to say is that I feel in our reply brief, we succinctly said that given the fact that Hill relies on district court cases, not the Supreme Court of Florida, and that the Supreme Court of Florida took it upon itself in Johnson.
You're arguing now that Hill's wrong.
Yes.
Do that anything about that, as you know?
Well, Judge, I guess I'm trying to make my record just for purposes of letting...
Consider it made.
Okay, thank you, Judge, for considering it. And then I'd like to just address Pedro, which I do feel that the sufficiency of the evidence in this case, if you look at the Pedro standard, is could a reasonable jury necessarily entertain a reasonable doubt? And the absolute answer in this case is yes, because Mr. Chambliss never possessed the firearm physically, and the record shows that the transaction happened between Hammond and between Rucker. And in fact, in closing, I argued that they could have owed each other money, and they simply tried to hold my client responsible for, I guess, being a broker is really what this case is about. And my position would be, and our brief talks about how the Pedro court noted the doctrines of constructive possession, that no mere knowledge is not enough, mere presence in the area of the object and awareness of its location is not sufficient to establish possession. And since the knowledge element is a key element, with no evidence of Chambliss holding the firearm, and in fact, supposedly it was a firearm transaction, but supposedly Rucker had seen him put the gun there, but he comes the first time and he doesn't even have the gun. But supposedly this whole conversation about bring the gun was what got him to come to the house the first time. That makes zero sense. And the jury could rely on that to say that there was reasonable doubt, and that as a matter of looking at Pedro, and why Pedro is important is its unique circumstances. This court could look at this case as having unique circumstances and make a Pedro-like finding that doesn't necessarily create some sort of a difficult precedent in 922G cases, but which recognizes the unique facts of this case where the sufficiency of the evidence was inadequate, and that would allow the judgment of acquittal, which was made and preserved at the end of the case, to be reinvigorated, and the case should be reversed based on those grounds. And I thank you for listening, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Next case up is U.S. versus Pawn. Government lawyers just changing chairs. That's convenient, very efficient.